Evolution is only a theory. Global warming is unproven. And science itself is just another opinion. Critics of mainstream science seem to be everywhere these days, and we as journalists just can't seem to get enough of them. It's just about impossible to pick up a newspaper or watch CNN for an hour without being confronted by someone attacking ideas that most scientists think are so settled that they aren't even worth discussing anymore. Meanwhile, the topics that many scientists are working on, the almost daily advances in nanotechnology and genetics, to pick just two, are largely absent from mass-market media coverage. What's going on? That's a passage from an article called Science and Journalism Fail to Connect. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
How do we figure out what's true about scientific advances when we have to rely for our information on journalists who sometimes lack understanding of the fields they're covering? How should journalists cover scientific controversies in an objective and helpful way? Joining us to discuss science and the media is Sharon Dunwoody, the F.U. Bascom Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Science and journalism, right away, it seems to me there's a couple of unlikely bedfellows there because scientists are after facts, sometimes very complicated interrelations between facts. Journalists are after that which is simple. They're after the lead. They're after the story.
Indeed, I think one of the imperatives of journalism is to tell a good story. For science journalists, the issue is how you do that within the boundaries of what's factually correct. And the subset of reporters spends a lot of time pondering that issue. They probably screw it up on occasion, but I think in general, they do a pretty darn good job of managing narrative within the confines, again, of what's possibly true and what isn't.
Is that changing at all? Do you think, has it changed over the years, the journalistic approach to science reporting?
I think it has, and I'm not sure scientists would welcome the changes that have occurred. I think early on, let's go back to the 50s and 60s when science journalists were a thriving community. During those times, I think there was a great emphasis on the progress of science, and many in the community began to accuse each other of producing what were called gee whiz stories, where you would track what was happening, what a scientist was doing in her lab. Out comes an article in a peer-reviewed journal like Science, and you land on it, and the story basically says, wow, look at this. Scientists, needless to say, I think, liked that approach a lot because you can imagine in that kind of a world, they literally controlled what became news about science, and everything that was newsworthy was cheery and adulatory. I think today, I think the 21st century calls on a very different kind of science journalism, and journalists have been responding. Now I think they care a lot about issues of evidence, about whether claims that scientists make are actually true or not, about the extent to which people can use the information provided. So the stories that you see become, I think, more and more complex, leave behind the scientific findings at times, leave behind the whoop-de-doo approach to a new research finding, and move on rather quickly to questions of what this means. Do other people agree with this information? How likely is this to be true in another decade?
Well, given the way scientists think, a lot of them, the way human nature works, aren't there almost always detractors whenever anybody comes up with, wow, here's an insight or here's a great idea, somebody else says, well, I don't know.
That's right. And that's not a bad thing. In fact, I think of science as being very much in the uncertainty production business rather than in the uncertainty reduction business. I think, and we all have the same reaction as we learn more and more about something that's near and dear to our hearts. Haven't you had this situation where the more you learn, the more questions you have about something? Well, that's what science is all about. The more scientists learn, the more questions they have. And that means that we're never really, scientists are never really completely sure about whether something is true or not. The scientific method permits them to test the validity of information on a continuing basis. And in that sense, I think science has a fabulous way of approaching what's true. But again, there's no way to land squarely on it. So what you often get with scientific developments are contested points of view. If something happens with respect to global warming, somebody announces a temperature trend, almost invariably another set of scientists will speak up and say, well, our data don't suggest that at all. And so science is a continuing negotiation between different points of view. Now, how we everyday people deal with that is another matter.
Well, and that brings up a point that seems to me to be changing over the years, and that is that a lot of the scientific writing has become increasingly specialized and difficult than even for a scientist in one field to read about it in another, because if you've got all kinds of specialized work in genetics where they're talking about DNA and in nanotechnology and in immunology, medical fields, I find that scientists in one field don't necessarily have the vocabulary even or the knowledge base to read about another field. And for a layperson, it really is like a foreign language at times. It makes it difficult to read the original sources.
Every discipline has its own language. We won't go into that. I mean, I think there are reasons why that's so. I think it's kind of important for experts to have their own languages that other people often can't understand. But that makes the kind of narratives that journalists produce or the documentary filmmakers produce, or that even movie makers produce, all the more important, because that's a whole subset of people designed to create usable narratives about science. And again, I think the warp and woof of science needs to be a part of those narratives, just as it is a part of science itself.
I think I read in one of the articles that you have in a collection here that many scientists actually get their science news from the New York Times now, or that they're more likely to give credibility to it if it's covered in a mainstream newspaper.
Right. Scientists don't think this is true. But in fact, it turns out we all use the mass media and other kinds of public channels in order to keep track of what's going on in our world, and scientists are no different from anyone else. What I find quite remarkable is that they use those channels even within their own areas of specialization. There have been a number of studies now that have demonstrated that if something gets picked up in the media, the visibility of that research is parlayed into increased numbers of citations in the scientific literature. And so what that suggests, of course, is that scientists are monitoring these public channels. And when something comes up, they view that as somehow more important than other things. So in fact, public visibility is important not only to the rest of us, but to scientists themselves.
Is there a phenomenon in today's world in particular in which, I'll use the word, hirelings are brought in to advocate for a certain kind of technology? For example, if you come out with a study, you put in the media a study that says trans fats are bad for you, then suddenly somebody who just may have been hired by the food industry as a scientist is saying, well, no, they're not, or we don't have all the data. Or the same thing for fossil fuels and global warming. I mean, that seems to be constantly the counter voice.
Right. I think there are pockets of people who do that for a living. I don't want to accuse all folks who generate controversy of being hired shills for another point of view. I think many people have strong beliefs about what's true that lead them to speak up when they hear something that doesn't fit their notion of what's valid. But it is pretty clear that particularly with some large issues, that individuals have made a point of trying to counter information. A well-known science historian, Naomi Oreskes, has just published a book called Merchants of Doubt, where she has detailed the efforts of a small number of eminent scientists to try to counter the growing research that suggests that humans are making a substantial change to a contribution to the anthropogenic warming of the climate. So there, again, I think these people may have actually felt strongly about their beliefs, but they very, very carefully built a kind of set of counterarguments that have been quite influential over time. That process was also, I think, unpacked when it came to an older issue, the prospect of smoking cigarettes and cancer.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
So there are, I think, people who are willing to take advantage of persuasive strategies to try to counter what appears to be a growing pile of evidence for something. And we need to find out who they are, and we need to uncover those issues so that the rest of the public can understand what's going on.
Well, are there rules in place now? Let's say you're writing a column for the Washington Post or New York Times or something on a scientific topic, and you're reporting on a study. Let's say it's a study that shows that grape juice can increase your longevity. But the study is perhaps funded by Welch's grape juice.
Right.
Are you required to report the funding of the studies you're reporting? Because it seems to me if you're going to have transparency, as with the tobacco company and other things, or the, you know, something will come out about how a drug is not as unsafe as they thought, but often it's funded by the drug company.
Right. There may be some media organizations that require provision of that kind of information. In most cases, journalists are not moving forward with those kinds of requirements. The field tends to rely on a kind of ethical jawboning to try to convince its members to behave in an ethical fashion. And I would guess as a result, those sorts of bits of information are provided in a sporadic, unpredictable fashion. I think that there are a lot of things that belong in stories that would help readers understand what's going on. One is indeed the question of where the money comes from. Another is, and I think many large media organizations are doing a better job of this, the use of other experts in addition to the ones making the truth claim. So if someone comes up with an article in Science magazine or in Nature about a particular dietary constituent, a large number of journalists now understand that they're responsible for contacting other experts to say, does this make sense to you? Is this sufficiently strong as a study to warrant moving forward?
So it's second sourcing, in effect.
Right. And in a world where journalists can't know what's true themselves, that kind of sourcing is absolutely critical. What journalists need to have, and they often talk about their stable of experts, people who they can turn to, often people who don't want to be on the record, but instead remain in background. In other words, a journalist will get a truth claim from a scientist, will essentially patch it off to another scientist and say, What do you think?
Can you verify this?
And actually use the reaction of this other scientist as a part of the decision-making about whether to run the story itself. So I think a good many stories don't ever show up because, again, this kind of background checking is underway.
But now how do you weight the opinion? In other words, if you have a story that says fossil fuel use causes global warming and you have a scientist over here who says, yes, it does, and you have one over here who says, no, it doesn't, doesn't that, by implication, force you into kind of taking a poll of all the scientists? In other words, to get the relative merits of this case, that fossil fuels cause global warming?
Yes. And this is where experience as a science journalist comes in. In fact, one of the things I advocate as I talk with students and journalists is that, again, journalists themselves are not specialists in science. They can't go out and pull an article out of the journal Cell, and read it and determine for themselves whether that's good enough, important enough to belong in a narrative in USA Today or something like that. So what a journalist has to do instead, though, is make a judgment about the importance of that information. What historically would happen is the journalist would just, if it's in cell, it's important, I'm going to go for it. And you basically relied on the peer review system of science, on the quality of the journal, and there still is a good bit of this going on, as the arbiter of what goes into your story and what doesn't. It's clear today that peer review, while a critical part of a quality control process, is not infallible, there's a double negative, is flawed, unable to capture all possible problems that occur in stories. So what I think journalists have to be responsible for is understanding what most scientists think is true, particularly for some of the big issues out there, and be able in stories to share with readers where what I call the weight of evidence lies. And so that means, in essence, you do need to do a poll. And it's a very hard thing to do. You can't just call up, 30 climate scientists and say, what do you think? It doesn't work that way. Instead, what you do is you build expertise. You build knowledge of the people in the field. If you've been a science writer for 10 or 15 years, you now know what most of the scientists, what most of the climate modelers think. And as a result, you're able to provide a kind of weight of evidence response. The people who are in trouble are the newbies, the people who just, like all beginners in an occupation,
don't have the connections.
Don't have the expertise. The little research that we have that looks at the quality of science writing, mostly in the United States, finds that, and this is a shock to scientists, it's not whether you have a formal science background that predicts quality. It's how many years you've been a science writer. And it's so, like all occupations, expertise in the occupation matters.
Well, I have a question for you. You mentioned that science is a matter of producing uncertainty in a way, that there's nothing where you can sort of lock in on it as the truth. But does that go too far in the sense that there are some issues, let's take gravity or evolution or other things, where the weight of evidence is such that if you went into it thinking that you needed to show the other right side, it might create a phony balance?
Absolutely. Clearly, there are many theories in science that are so well established that, in fact, as lay people, as non-scientists, as journalists, we're not going to go in and contest them. I think where we writers have to be alert is when someone, again, claims a new development. And I remember, for example, years ago when a group of scientists funded by NASA held a press conference. You saw in front of you a Martian meteorite that they felt contained fossilized remnants of life. Now, if they're right, that's pretty dramatic. And I remember as somebody reading a newspaper and watching television, seeing this information and thinking, wow, what a story. There's that sort of gee whizzy kind of
sure
thing. But what you now have to do as a journalist is you're not going to contest whether meteorites can find their way from
Mars to Earth.
You're not going to go back and force scientists to explain all of the basic principles that govern those processes. But I think it is important now to begin to ask really serious questions about the likelihood that this group of scientists is right, because it turns out that the fossilized bits of stuff they were finding in this meteorite could come from other things as well. And in the long, as that story has unfolded over the years, it seems more and more likely that those fossilized bits are not remnants of life. But
doesn't make for very exciting journalism,
exactly,
does it?
Exactly. So the trick, I think, is, again, when the science is new, to care a lot about the uncertainties that are embedded in it. I mean, the uncertainties will be overflowing with that kind of finding. And a journalist has to be sensitive to that and begin to ask questions, again, about the validity, about whether, how likely this could be true, what are the alternate explanations, and take it from there. The problem will be when, and we've all run into these as both as journalists and lay colleagues, are the long-running contested science stories of the day, like evolution, like global warming, where, again, we are confronted with an almost daily barrage of he said stories, people seeming to come out of the woodwork on all sides of an issue. And it never seems to stop. You begin to wonder after a while if anybody is going to be able to figure out what's true when you see coverage like that.
Well, I mean, you do have to tease out those vested interests again, don't you? I mean, because if somebody comes up with a new idea, a patent or something, we know what happens.
Right.
That usually they're slapped with any number of patent infringement lawsuits to just kind of bog things down endlessly. That's a history that we've seen repeated over and over.
Right.
Or if it's evolution, what's their point of view going into this issue?
Right. Those long-running controversial stories, I think, require enormous skill on the part of writers, of communicators, for lots of reasons. One is that there are all kinds of motives at work, not just scientific motives. And if you're trying to write about this as an advance in science, you need to be aware of what those other motives are and try to help readers understand. Another issue, though, is that if an issue has been sort of culturally established as controversial, lay audiences now expect to see different points of view. And if you ride in on your white horse as a journalist and say, by gosh, you know, humans are making a substantial contribution to the warming of the globe, people who think this is still undecided are nuts. Consequently, I declare to you readers that, you know, global warming is happening and we have to do something about it. That may well be true. I mean, the nuts part I wouldn't be quite so vivid about if I were writing it. But I, you know, personally think that indeed the evidence is overwhelming that humans are making that kind of a contribution to warming or to climate change or climate disruption. We're now in the process of rummaging around for different terms
so
for these things.
That's part of that constant revisionism, too.
Exactly.
Between science and journalism.
But what I also know is that if I try to say that in a story, a big chunk of my readers, listeners, viewers will get angry at me because that's not my role. My role as a writer is not to declare what's true. My role is to be a transmitter.
And to say so-and-so says this is
right.
The way it is.
Right. So if I want to be read or viewed and believed, what I'm going to have to do in a story is lay out the fact that there are different points of view. And I have to show some respect for those other points of view as well, even if I don't think they're true. The trick, I think, and this is that weight of evidence approach again, is to be able to do that while saying, communicating to my audience that that point of view is overwhelmingly likely to be the correct one.
It does kind of remind me a little bit, though, of the old story about Mark Twain, you know, who was faulted for making, as a journalist, unsubstantiated claims and wound up watering down his story. So it was the alleged mayor of Virginia City and his alleged wife attended.
Right. Yes. Yes, you could certainly overdo it. And I think journalists have developed habits of mind that don't serve them well when it comes to these kinds of stories. For example, confronted, and we have, again, a couple of researchers who've done a lot of work in analyzing media coverage of global warming. And what they find is that journalists do what they call balance points of view. So they find somebody at one end of the attitudinal continuum, somebody who believes that humans are making a significant contribution. They then find somebody at the other end who thinks that this is all just nothing's happening other than the gigantic wheels of climate within the framework of the cosmos, and that you don't have, you know, we can't tell anything about what's going on. And then they give those two points of view equal space in the story.
Now, do you want to make a distinction between print journalism and broadcast journalism? It seems to me it'd be much easier to do that kind of thing in print journalism than
right.
If, say, you're doing a call-in show.
That's right. And I'm talking here mostly about the sort of built narratives, although I see this in television as well, in the news shows, again, that where a journalist has an opportunity to construct the narrative about an issue. Given the opportunity to construct, balance is a very common strategy employed. Now, and the reason I think it's employed is not because the journalist is stupid about this. In fact, there is at least one study that suggests when a study of journalists' coverage of controversies where one side of the controversy is a maverick, a kind of outlier. For example, an erstwhile geologist some years ago who suddenly claimed that there was a 50-50 chance of a major earthquake with an epicenter in Missouri. This was a number of years ago. And not only did they make that dramatic claim, but they claimed this would happen by a certain date.
Well, based on the New Madrid experience of 1811.
The New Madrid fault, yeah. That's right. And as a result of this claim, thousands of people fled on the date in question just to be sure they weren't there when the walls came down. And of course, what geologists knew full well is that while that's a very active region seismically, the chances of a quake there were pretty darn small. And in fact, there was no reason to be concerned. But journalists wrote stories that gave this alleged geologist a great deal of credibility through this whole balancing process. And a researcher tracked that coverage and then went and talked to the journalists. And they said, he's a nutcase. They said that, you know, we know that that's unlikely that there's going to be an earthquake.
So why did they cover him?
Good story? Sold papers?
They did that because their editor expected them to balance the story. In other words, this is a very standard narrative structure in journalism. And the editor, if they came in with a, you know, this guy's crazy, the editor would say, where's the other side of the story? So they felt compelled to provide that kind of legitimacy.
But you get back to this question of taking a poll, in effect, because if you have a legitimate scientist over here saying there will not be a quake in New Madrid anytime soon, as far as we can tell, and maybe 100 or let's say 80% of geologists support that point of view.
Right.
Do you really feel compelled to find somebody representing the other 20 or the other 10% or the other 5%?
Yes, isn't that screwy?
And is that balance?
Well, according to some journalistic imperatives, that is balance. And what they're saying, I think, and this is a little perverse, but stick with me. What they're saying is, since I, journalist, can't tell you what's true, what I'm really saying to you is the truth is in here. The truth is in this story. So it's a kind of surrogate for validity claims. It's like, I can't tell you which is true, but I can tell you that it's in here.
And make your own conclusions.
And unfortunately, and this is where I think this is such a bad strategy, what readers or viewers conclude is nobody knows what's true. And that's not the goal of the journalist. So I think this strategy is actually pretty bad. But it's been a very common one over the years, and you still see instances of editors, a journalist, you know, writing a story, and evolution is an example of this, and editors coming back and say, you know, where's the other side of this issue? So there is this kind of balance imperative out there. It's diminishing. Again, some of the research that's been done on global warming coverage is finding now that journalists are finally comfortable with the idea that they don't have to contact the other side of the issue, that they can now move forward with stories that assume that humans are making this kind of a contribution. But remember, what journalism does is it doesn't lead us, it follows, okay?
Sure,
It's not out ahead of the game.
It's not the newsmaker.
It's
a news
reactive.
Reporter.
In a controversial arena, whether about science or not, what journalists do is they wait until the culture has decided what's true. And then they feel comfortable, I think, writing stories that are, you know, that in essence assert a particular truth. But that's not helpful to us, is it? I mean, we everyday people need help at the front end of an issue.
Makes them sound more like historians than journalists.
Right. Especially if it's something where we're trying to figure out, do we take this medicine or eat this food or do this thing today?
Exactly.
We're going to talk about more specific cases of science and the media when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. All scientific work is incomplete, whether it be observational or experimental. All scientific work is liable to be upset or modified by advancing knowledge. That does not confer upon us a freedom to ignore the knowledge we already have or to postpone action that it appears to demand at a given time. Who knows, asked Robert Browning, but the world may end tonight. True, but on available evidence, most of us make ready to commute on the 8:30 train the next day. That's from Sir Austin Bradford Hill's address to the Royal Society of Medicine in 1965. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Sharon Dunwoody, and we're talking about science and the media. We have to listen to these stories that present information, flawed as it may be or conflicted as it may be, and then we have to make a decision, like in that quote, to get up and go to work, or in some cases to take a medicine, or in another, perhaps whether or not to give our child a vaccine that some reports say might cause autism.
That's right. Almost everything we do is done within a context of uncertainty. And we fundamentally acknowledge that in many ways. When we decide to cross the street in the middle of a block, we're looking both ways and judging that the likelihood of getting clobbered in this process is low enough that we're willing to take the risk. So we do these kinds of things all the time. And yet, when it comes to a lot of contested issues, uncertainty suddenly becomes a kind of rhetorical problem for us. You'll see in cases where, again, folks want to believe a certain route is correct. They'll often argue that the uncertainties inherent in the other route are overwhelming and we should be sensitive to them. So I think it's very difficult for people to operate in worlds where, again, they either feel like nobody knows what's true or they have very strong beliefs about what's true. The vaccine issue is an interesting one because it arose to some extent through a process of families encountering situations that impel a interpretation that vaccines were linked to autism. A world where, you know, your child is vaccinated and then reasonably soon after that is diagnosed with autism. When those kinds of things happen, when we call them co-occurrences, statistical co-occurrences, we're much more likely to notice when those two things overlap than when they don't. In fact, in this country, millions of infants are vaccinated and are not subsequently diagnosed with autism. We don't notice those, but we notice the co-occurrence of those two things. And it's very common for us. It's the same phenomenon. I don't want to belittle this particular linkage, but I often see claims that couples who cannot conceive and who then adopt are more likely to conceive after having adopted than are couples who just grin and bear it. And there is no pattern, okay? And yet I have people just see it in the real world and be very, very convinced that that's true.
Anecdotal evidence.
Right, and they develop all kinds of rationales. If you adopt, then maybe you relax and you're then more, the situation is better for conception and so on. What's happening, of course, is you and I, as we go through life, we notice when a couple who's just adopted suddenly gets pregnant. We never notice the other cell where all these couples who adopt don't get pregnant. So again, anecdotal information, we build our lives on it. There's ample evidence that we use it. It's very powerful. And in the autism situation, I think this kind of evidence is just, I mean, I'm a victim of not of that particular co-occurrence, but I see co-occurrences all the time in my life. And I feel strongly about some of them. So what do you do if you're a writer and you encounter a community like this one, where individuals believe that there is a causal link between vaccines and autism?
Including celebrities, because sometimes that increases media coverage if you have a celebrity.
Exactly. And where there is a, you can find on the web, on Facebook, you can find other people who feel the same way.
Well, of course, that internet adds a whole new dimension, doesn't it, to whatever you want to call it in quotation marks, maybe science reporting.
Right. That's right. And again, the internet permits people, once an individual has developed beliefs about something, the internet permits that person to find others who feel the same way.
Which, of course, I guess is also human nature. If you have a supposition, you're more inclined to look for support than detraction.
That's right. And journalists do this too, of course. You know, once they develop a theory about how something works, they're much more likely to see evidence that supports that theory to be good evidence than other types of evidence. So we're all this way. I mean, there's nothing stupid about this. There's nothing ignorant about it. This is very much a part of human nature. But it's also a part of us that we need to be cautious about. Journalists need to be cautious if they find themselves leaning towards certain types of evidence. We folks need to be just as cautious if we find ourselves making linkages. We need to pull back and ask ourselves what's going on. But you see them all the time. For example, just to pillory journalists a little more, I remember in a particular journal, there were two articles side by side. These were research reports. One found health impacts of nuclear radiation. The other didn't. Okay. And when you looked at media coverage of that stuff, overwhelmingly, journalists picked the study that found the effects. And not the study that didn't.
Yeah, there's a non-story.
A non-story. Yeah. And there's a kind of, my guess is, a sense that radiation is kind of dangerous. So this fit, this notion that there were health impacts sort of fit with journalists' cultural sense of what's true and what isn't. So we all have to be careful about these things. The problem is once you've developed these really, really robust beliefs, and I think some families with autistic children have. I mean, imagine the tragedy, I mean, of this kind of a diagnosis, and you need an explanation for what's going on. It's a terrible illness in that sense. Truly no one seems to know what causes it. Once you develop a strong belief about that, it turns out you're not going to change that belief.
So let's say you were writing a story today on autism and the possible link to the vaccine. You're going to write a story that you would feel was responsible journalism.
Right.
What would you include in it? What would you do so that the message a reader would receive would be appropriate?
Yeah. What I think I would have to do is reflect the state of the science today, which is that there is no link, no link has been found through any kind of systematic study between vaccines and a diagnosis of autism. So I need to be able to reflect the evidence in the story that makes that point. But then I also need to go on and in some way incorporate into this story a sense of why a very important subset of people in our community feel differently about this.
Well, and that's kind of a interesting difference maybe in the way a journalist for a science magazine or a specialized one would write versus one in what I'll call the mainstream or popular media, where the emphasis for some time now has been you start with the story of an individual and then build the general story around that. So in other words, you would start with a story about a couple whose child – presumably unafflicted, has then this vaccination and suddenly somehow is diagnosed as autistic.
Right.
But then you have to build that into the context of general scientific thinking on the phenomenon or the lack of a phenomenon.
Right. You know, I think that one of the pieces of advice I give to journalists, and it's not often taken, is that, again, many narratives are the more human the narrative, the more powerful it is. And again, journalists are fundamentally storytellers and need to be storytellers because that's how you and I make sense of the world around us. So I think this is a critical part of the business, and journalists need to employ strategies that attract audiences, that keep them in the story, that then allow them to see what's get a sense of what's true and what isn't.
Start with the concrete and then work to the abstract.
Right. The problem is if you pick the wrong narrative beginning, if you pick the wrong couple, you are going to set a framework for that story that will predispose people to think in a certain way.
Well, you could skew the results if you pick a very atypical couple and have that be your case study, then skew it.
Right.
I would assume you'd also have to talk about the dangers of not vaccinating.
Right. That's right. But what you would do from a weight of evidence approach is you first find out what typical is. And in this case, typical is the couple that vaccinates a child and encounters no health repercussions as a result.
It's just a little harder to build a human interest story.
Yeah. That's where the skill. Who was the journalist long ago who said there are no boring stories, only boring storytellers? So part of being a superb storyteller is being able to tell that story. You may ultimately invoke another family who feels differently.
Yes, but I think despite the warning of this other family, this family went in and got the vaccination without incident.
Right. Kind of thing. But still, I think what I advise journalists to do is to first find out what the patterns are, what's most likely to be true, and then to build a vivid narrative on the pattern. Another sort of less vivid example, if you will, is I remember stories from many years ago. I don't know why I was focused on these darn things, but about two career couples who lived in different parts of the country. Again, a very common situation for many career couples today. And the state of those relationships. Okay. Now, very often I would see stories where you would go out and find couples that had fallen apart because of, you know, distance had turned them into strangers. Yes. Mm-hmm. It turns out if you look at the data in sociology, the typical pattern is just the opposite. Couples who live apart tend to have much healthier relationships.
Makes the heart grow fonder.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there's a case where if I wanted to write a story about two career couples in distant locations, what I need to do first is go to the literature, find out what the prevailing pattern is, and then go find a couple that fits that pattern.
You're talking about doing statistical research.
Yes,
in other words,
that's right.
I would think the math behind a lot of this would be important. How many cases,
right?
What percent of something is a
that's
certain
right. Amount. That's right. You have to be able to some extent, as a journalist, evaluate evidence. You can't be the expert. You can't be the sociologist who studies these couples. You can't be the climate modeler who is running gigantic models, you know, that are exploring what's happening up in the atmosphere. You can't be that person. But you can, I think, know enough about evidence to be able to make some rough estimates about what's likely to be true that you then back up with your stable of experts. So those experts, I think, remain a very important part of your life as well.
More on Science in the Media when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Sharon Dunwoody. And we are looking at media and science, how journalists report science stories, how they keep them balanced, if indeed they do. And that raises the question of, as a user, as a reader, as a listener to a science story, what's our responsibility?
Yeah. As somebody who reads a lot myself, I mean, I'm very much a consumer of science information in the media, in a lot of locations. I think the best thing an audience member can do is triangulate, which is one of those technical terms, but it really, really means is no single story is good enough to convince you of anything. And we now, thanks to this great internet world, have access to as many versions of a story as we want. It's really fabulous. Now, admittedly, most of us don't have time to sit and graze across, you know.
Well, there's
10...
some vetting issues, too.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of junk out there.
There's a lot of junk. Although, I have faith in audiences. If you take a look at what people do as they monitor the environment around them on the internet, they're doing things that are very much like what they used to do pre-internet. In other words, the internet sites that pull information together, that vet it journalistically and present it, are the most popular internet sites for this kind of public affairs surveillance work that you and I need to do. So we go to CNN.com. We go to MSNBC.com. We go to, this is probably me, of course, but we go to the New York Times website. In other words, we know that we are not experts at sifting through a variety of points of view.
And those are credible sources.
And adjudicating. So we're doing very much what we did 25 years ago when newspapers were king. And essentially, I think that is, in fact, a very smart thing to do. We go to people who are vetting creating narratives. And then the trick, I think, is to triangulate across those narratives. Any big science story is going to get picked up across these outlets. And the trick then is to forage, to explore the different narratives that are coming out, give yourself the opportunity to be confused. And that leads you to acknowledge that no one has a lock on what's true at the moment.
For those of us who are pressed for time, it seems to me there's a danger in trusting headlines, because what I've seen is that the same story can have a completely different slant just depending on what some editor puts in as a headline. You could take the same scientific study about a drug, and one headline might read, drug causes heart attacks. Another headline might say, drug less dangerous than thought. It's actually the exact same results, but
right.
The take on it is different.
Yes. Too much satisficing, too much acting like a sort of greyhound coursing over the top of information, you know, with just little dips in, is going to give you a very fragmented and confusing picture of what's going on. Part of being, I think, a responsible citizen of the world is giving ourselves enough time to get down below those headlines and giving ourselves enough time, again, to cross modes, including, again, I think some of the very best explanation about what's happening with science in the world is occurring not so much in print, but in places like radio. One of my, again, favorite programs in addition to yours is Radiolab, which is one of the most interesting explanatory radio programs I have ever encountered, where they take on difficult statistical issues and help you understand what's happening through examples and all kinds of things. So I think there's a lot of help for folks out there if they will take advantage of it. The folks who already know what's true are not going to do this.
Because what they're going to think they know what's true, you mean?
Yes. Well, they know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the point. They know what's true. So they will go to sites that reinforce
right.
those points of view. But again, for the rest of us who aren't entirely sure about what's true, which I view as a very, very healthy state, again, moving across platforms is really important. It's also, it turns out, really useful in terms of learning. A lot of people flagellate media coverage of conflict as if coverage that focuses on contested information or contested points of view is inherently a bad idea. I would contest that. In fact, we learn more when we encounter information that airs different points of view than when we encounter information that has just one point of view. The fact that somebody disagrees just gets us going, okay? We're alert. We begin to soak this information up. So, in fact, you get more learning with conflict than you do in worlds where everyone seems to agree. So this kind of triangulation is another way of exposing yourself to different points of view, potentially different points of view, and that's going to enhance your own ability to learn what's going on. There's some evidence as well, and as somebody on the sort of back end of life at this point, that in fact, if you want to keep your brain going, exposing yourself to a variety of points of view is really important as well. So I can't see a downside to this.
Too.
Yeah, that's right.
You mentioned the problem of newbies in the scientific journalism field, that you know, people do better if they've had 10, 15 years in the field. But let's say you're addressing a class of freshman science journalism students. What would you, and you only had them for, you know, a couple minutes, what
right.
would you give them as a 2-minute, you know, sort of commencement speech? This is what you must do in this field to be honorable scientific journalists.
Yeah. I think what you have to do is be skeptical, not cynical. Cynicism, I think, is an unfortunate byproduct of fatigue and feelings of helplessness. But skepticism is a way of saying, I understand what you're saying, but I'm not entirely convinced yet you're right. And what I need to do is explore this issue a little more in order to decide for myself if this is right. I think it's a general human reaction that we could all do better to adopt. But I think for young writers, for people at the very beginnings of careers, skepticism is something that is very, very important. It's often missing in action because we're so... Something about expertise, isn't it, that makes us just turn into sponges, little namby-pamby, you know. Somebody tells us to do something and go, oh, yes, yes,
passive.
I'll do that, yes. Call this number, yes, I'll do that. I just did that the other day. And again, that's not skepticism. So I think that's what we need more than anything else.
Except when it comes to what you've told us for the last hour. Our guest has been Sharon Dunwoody. And thanks for joining us and filling us in about a more critical approach to reading and hearing scientific reporting.
Thank you very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 as our two guests, one from Kenya and the other from Nigeria, give us some insights into how African languages illuminate culture. That's University of the Air next Sunday afternoon at 4. Join us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.